place called New York City or, you know, Queens, and walking around those streets and listening, savoring, you know, hearing the voices, it's sort of like an alien world, right?
Yeah, I love that quote you gave in a recent interview where you said, all immigrant novels are dystopian novels. They're just not dystopias for most of the readers.
That's right.
That's a great way to look at it, I think.
It really is, and I think that's so true. But this time, of course, the dystopia is the dystopia for everybody. Although, of course, the people inside the story don't feel that it's a dystopia. It's just for us, you know, the reader outside. Inside, the people have all too accepted the world as it is.
Well, let's set the stage of the world building a little for our listeners. There are three types of societies that occur in America of the novel. So can you tell us a little bit about what these societies are?
Yeah. I'm not specific about the time period, but it's about 150, 200 years from now, not 1,000 years, not 50. And the society is broken down pretty much into three parts. The part that is sort of the central part of the novel is a place called Bemore, and it's the former Baltimore, which comes up, you know, that's why the name is Bemore. And in Bemore, it's a production facility in which they raise indoor tanks of fishes and vegetables. And these are foodstuffs that are meant to be free of contaminants. And they're destined for the rich charter class who live in their own gated communities and can afford such things. So those are sort of two parts of the society. And the charters are, you know, the sort of people that we would consider probably the 1% or the 0.5%, people with a lot of resources, who have had education, who have good health care, who have everything that they really need. And outside the production facility and the charter villages is where really most everyone else lives, and that's called the open counties. And that's a land in which you just might think of sort of an Appalachian-type environment, where there's really no oversight, there's no government to speak of, there are no laws that people follow.
And certainly no safety net.
So one of the characters that the hero of the story first meets is a fellow who runs a sort of health clinic. But it turns out, of course, he just used to be a veterinarian.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And another big part of the world building is that a lot of the people in the story are actually originally from China. And the place that they're from has become so polluted that they become immigrants to the United States and inhabit abandoned cities in the United States.
Right, and that's what Bemore is. You know, it was repurposed urban decayed land, pretty much, neighborhoods that had been just forlorn and neglected and abandoned. And so all these people came over from China because their own land was poisoned. But they had some, you know, production skills. And of course, America is a place in which these particular kinds of immigrants were not only welcomed, but needed. They need these people to you know, make these foodstuffs for the elite classes.
One way that was really interesting to me was when you think about America and its relationship to its own history, it almost feels like it's always trying to escape it in a lot of ways, say, compared to Mexico, which incorporates its indigenous past into the mythos, into the flag, into the current day narrative. America seems to try to move away from that past. And similarly, it feels to me like the Chinese, when they move here, sort of push out whoever is already there, or at least they become peripheral and marginalized. And I was curious if you saw any parallel between the Chinese and the Americans in their relationship to history.
Well, the Chinese, of course, are deeply interested in their own history. They have one of the richest and longest, you know, recorded histories of any civilization. So in that sense, no. But I think when these settlers come to America, something happens to them, right? I mean, in America, our manifest destiny is always about a frontier. It's not good business to look backwards. And I think that's one of the things that the book has an anxiety about. It has an anxiety about this constant, maybe unsustainable striving that has led the society to break down into these three different parts. And that, you know, so that some people are just merely servicers of those with means. And that those with means, you know, have all these sort of obsessive neurotic tendencies because they really have nothing else to worry about. So it's a, I think it's a peculiarly American gift and kind of flaw that we have.
And so in a sense, these Chinese immigrants are taking on an American quality when they come to these emptied cities.
Well, yeah, and I pick up the stories of 4 or 5 generations past. So these people are, quote unquote, more assimilated than just being fresh from China.
And what's really interesting about that, about the generations past, is even though this novel is a novel that's taking place in the future, it feels like a past haunted novel. All the people's backstories are haunting the current day in so many ways, and it's because everyone is displaced. Everyone is essentially an immigrant and is overshadowed by the world that was.
Yes, and overshadowed by the world that is. I mean, I think all the people, even the charters who seem to have everything, and especially, of course, the counties people who have nothing, each of these groups is highly unsettled in where they are. They each have different issues. The issue that's different for the what the Bimors face, even though they have, you know, kind of a middle class trappings, they have decent enough food and they have some health care, even if it is second rate. But what they don't have is a certain kind of freedom, and I don't just mean political freedom. But they have they've accepted and made a bargain in trading a life of safety for a certain kind of suppression of their destiny. So they know that from the time they're born to the time they die, they'll never leave the walls, and they don't really want to. But there's something soulful that dies in that, I think, and also something about imagination that gets diminished. And that's one of the things that begins to arise in Bimor when one of their own leaves the walls. Her leaving is this audacious act in their view, and they can't help but start to wonder, well, why did she leave us, and what's this place about now?
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Between the Covers, and we're talking today with author Chang Rae Lee about his latest novel, On Such a Full Sea. So, Chang Rae, you mentioned the heroine, Fan, and what is really interesting about her, obviously what's unnerving about her in Bimor is her choice to depart from the city. But what's also interesting is you have this grand landscape, you have climate change, you have unexplained disease epidemics, you have the eroding safety net and this major upheaval and translocation of different peoples. And in some ways, the heroine is, obviously her story is a personal story, but it's intimate and modest, and she's actually physically small. And her concerns in some ways are very intimate and modest. It's a quest for love, with this backdrop of this big sweeping upheaval. Mm-hmm. And I'd love it if you'd talk a little bit about that counterbalance and how you see that functioning in the book.
Yeah, I think normally we assume that the hero or heroine will not just be the swashbuckler, but have this whole raft of philosophical and maybe political, social ideas about what they're doing out in this quest. And that's I think, just typical. But this particular hero, this particular Fan, I just saw her at the start as someone who was outside of all the burdens or the concerns that all the peoples that we've mentioned have. You know, as you say, she's very modest. She only is really just looking for her boyfriend. But the audacity of her act to put herself in danger, and even though she doesn't really report to us about how she feels about that, is enough to inspire all sorts of kind of responses from the people back home in Bimor. You know, they begin painting sort of handmade, you know, painting murals of her and her boyfriend on the walls. They start littering in protest of some against some kind of suppression in this in the community. They begin, some of them even begin shaving their heads in a kind of act of solidarity. Not that she has a shaved head, but so it's really more, she's more almost a mirror to the folks back home in terms of how they're looking out at the world. They look at her, they experience this, the all these different dangers and characters, and they not only they find her, you know, captivating because of her bravery, which is again a bravery just of again being there rather than saying or doing something so brave, but they also see how her departure has left a void in their lives, and thus, you know, allows them to begin analyzing that that void for all the ways in which it's not satisfactory.
Well, I love this quote that you said in an interview around your last book, The Surrendered, that war was the first human story, but it is the aftermath of war where we are truly fascinated. You know, so Homer's Odyssey is the journey after the war. And similarly here, we have both Fan's journey after the unnamed upheaval, which we don't ever really fully know how we got to the current day circumstance of the book. But we also have the story being told in the aftermath of her leaving. So it's a very interesting mirroring of the Enterprise of the Surrendered in that sense.
Yeah, I'm always interested in aftermath because, you know, when the thing happens, say a crime, an act, some, you know, cataclysmic event, I think it's just overwhelming. You know, we just sort of have to experience it, take it in, and there's this kind of quiet afterwards. But it's in that quiet, I think, that the most interesting questions arise. And that's the response that we put into it, right? That we then interpret it and reshape it by our own very own actions. And so much of this book is not just the following of Fan's actions, but in the aftermath of this, you know, kind of condition, but also the very act of telling her story, that the narrator, who is a collective narrator from Be More, they seem to be suddenly sort of listening to themselves. And refiguring Fan and refiguring her adventures along the lines of maybe what they need and what they want to see.
Well, let's have you read a little bit from the book for our listeners today.
This is about Fan's work. She's a diver in the fish tanks, and so it's a little description of her. Once submerged, a diver is not easily seen. Given all the fish in the water, naturally, as many healthy fish are raised as possible, she is a mere shadow among them, trained to do her tasks quickly and unobtrusively. That is why she uses no special breathing apparatus aside from a snorkel, compressed gases causing too much of a disturbance. Fearful fish are not happy fish. The diver is not, quote, one of them, unquote, but is part of the waterscape from the time they are hatchlings, and they see her customary form and the repeated cadence of her movements and the gentle motor of her flippered feet that must come to them like a motherly lullaby, a dream song of refuge, right up to the moment of harvest. The diver is there at harvest, of course, and sees to it that the very last of them finds its way into the chute. And it is only then, for the span of the few hours while the tank is being cleaned and filtered before the next generation of hatchlings is released, that the water is clear of activity, that the diver is alone.
You mentioned just before reading that the narrator is a collective voice, is the first person plural, the we voice. And it's basically the town of Be More, the middle class society, telling the story of Fan as it unfolds. Tell us about the choice to, this is the other, I would say, big departure for you from your previous books, not just that it's in the future, but this voice that you found, which is really distinct. I would be curious why you chose this voice and what purpose you feel like it serves narratively.
Obviously the most instant and easy choice would have just have Fan describe her own story, tell us in her own words or thoughts what was going on, or have a third person kind of omniscient following her, you know, from above. But I very quickly felt that this novel was also a novel about community, about the ways in which a community functions and self-regulates. And so it seemed really natural once I started using the we, even though it sort of terrified me, because I, you know, you don't see many examples of the we used in fiction. And I didn't quite know where it would lead me, you know, and how long it could sustain itself. But one of the things that began to happen as I used the we was, you know, a certain kind of tonality of the fable began to arise, which I quite liked. And of course, it's sort of almost an oral tradition, as if we were all sitting around the fire. And also what the we does, and it, again, this is none of this is planned, but just sort of recognized during the process, is that when you say the we, you automatically involve the reader, because the reader becomes part of the we, whether he or she wants to be or not. And it's this little tension, that frisson of tension about that, that I think is quite interesting as we get into the story. So I like that. I like the idea, but ultimately I decided that the we would not be an absolute and consistent voice. That sometimes the we would be unreliable, maybe even confused, maybe almost emotional and hopeful about the things that we were seeing. And so I let it kind of free float from sometimes omniscience to sometimes, you know, intimate psychological kind of expression, to almost sometimes second person address of the reader, asking the reader to be part of the story and to, you know, to try to enlist the reader's sympathies. So I sort of feel like, even though it's a we, it's sort of all the points of view.
I think that's what makes this book so unique is, I mean, obviously with the we, one of the things you think of is the Greek chorus, and you think of authority, omniscience, and here with the uncertainty and even anxiety of the we, it really is a unique way to enter a book, and it mirrors the middle class anxiety of the town itself. I mean, the town has a very small number of people who would graduate to the charters, and then obviously that has people that are expelled to the open counties. But even the people who are within it, there's just, you can tell there's a real suppressed but tangible, palpable anxiety.
Oh yeah, they have a lot to be worried about, you know, healthcare for one, for example. I mean, there's quite a bit in the book about how people, because their healthcare is sort of catastrophic healthcare, but not really a very good one, that when they get into trouble, say with some, you know, really serious disease, they can't afford it. And so, and they know they're not gonna afford it. And so lots of people are offing themselves to sacrifice themselves so that they won't hurt their families. So there's, you know, that's one of the things that they're worried about. They're worried about, of course, their livelihood. You know, there's a little bit of a boycott of during the middle of the book of the fishes and vegetables that they grow, because the charters suddenly think, oh my God, maybe they're poisoned. You know, maybe they'll give us this disease called C that everyone gets. And that causes a great disturbance in the society. So even though that their society is regulated and their lives are regulated, they're not immune and totally shielded from a lot of, a lot of the concerns that I think, you know, we all have about our lives today.
Well, earlier this year, I read a book by Robert Boswell, his latest, called Tumble Down, and he was attempting to create what he considered a new point of view called unreliable omniscience. And this reminds me of another version of the unreliable omniscience. And I've been thinking a lot about the parallels between the way literature shifts and the way society and philosophy and science shifts. And when you think about the fall of the collective belief in God and then the decline in the objective and omniscient point of view and narrative, the rise of radical subjectivism and consumer capitalism and hyper-individuated societies, this feels like sort of a grasping out to try to find a way to stitch back together a fabric of the public commons that would resonate, because the pure omniscient I think with the journey we've gone through wouldn't resonate in the same way it would at the time of George Eliot and Tolstoy.
Right. It can't work anymore because we can peek behind the curtain.
Right.
Through, you know, our knowledge of modernity, psychology, postmodernism.
Exactly.
So it just seems stiff and kind of false. At the same time, you know, psychologically, we distrust the individual voice because we know all these things have inhabited it and comprised that voice and consciousness. So and just look at the way that our social media works, and the ways in which, you know, we all say on Yelp, we all in a communal voice in a certain way, in an amalgam, decide upon things. It's not perfect by any means, but it certainly is fascinating for all the ways in which, you know, manifold voices can become one voice, although that voice, again, is distrusted.
Well, I wonder then if the unreliable omniscience that maybe is a seed of a new trend, like the Occupy movement, could be in a way to try to feel its way towards, you know, trying to bring back something economically that's been lost.
Yeah.
It's interesting parallel at this sort of extreme end of what's going on in the world.
It really is. I mean, I like the way that you... I didn't know about the Boswell book, but it seems to make a lot of sense to me, is that, you know, we both... It seems authentic and clear-sighted as much as we would accept something authentic and clear-sighted.
Sure.
Right?
Right.
And that's the constant tension in our world now. We want to believe, but it's so hard to.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Chiang Rai Lee about his novel On Such a Full Sea. Let's talk a little bit about the title. It has two meanings, and I'm not going to reveal what one of them is because it happens somewhat far into the book. But one of them is included in the epigram from Shakespeare,
right,
from Julius Caesar. Can you talk a little bit about how you chose the title and how it relates to this play?
Sure. I first of all, I had a terrible time finding a title for this novel, and I just happened to be reading Julius Caesar, which I'd read before a long time ago, and it's one of the great plays of his. And then I came across that what is a very famous speech by Brutus to Cassius about a kind of precarious or dangerous moment and seizing the opportunity in that moment to move forward, and to cause change and positive change. He's speaking metaphorically, of course, but you know, on such a full sea are we now afloat. But those words, the words themselves, I thought had a wonderful ring to it, as a lot of Shakespeare does. He's very reliable as a titlist. But also, it seemed to capture perhaps, you know, the figure of Fan quite well for me, that she's the only one in this precarious and fragile society who, you know, who's putting herself in the position, situating herself in such a way that, not that she's going to lead anybody, but that she's going to mark out some kind of path through this wilderness. And that to me was quite inspiring. And also there's a lot of water imagery in the book, and of course Brutus is speaking metaphorically, but I like the fact that she's a diver and that she's kind of, you know, kind of going into the depths of, you know, the deep and profound problems of this new society.
I was curious if Moby Dick was another influence, not just because of the water and fish themes, but also as another book that deals with American consumerism and capitalism, and the obvious downside of the monomania of that. But also, you have a couple characters, Quig and Star, and I wondered if they were Queequeg and Starbuck. Am I reading too far?
Well,
into that?
You're not reading too far. I think you know, whenever you have a Q character in an American fiction, I think you have to think about Queequeg. But yeah, I mean. And also the figure of the whale, right? I mean, the whale is sort of a way that all the characters can write themselves into into the landscape, right? Into the destiny of that story. The whale itself has, of course, no consciousness. It's the consciousness that and presence that it's given is all by those who look around it. And you know, I don't want to, you know, try to elevate or you know, make anything grandiose, but Fan is sort of the same character. She's elemental, you know, and there's something about her that's both kind of absent, but, you know, absent of a kind of human consciousness in the ways that we normally get human consciousness in a maximal way in a fiction. But also she's, I don't know, a kind of canvas that we all want to write on, at least the people in B'more do. And so I, you know, there was something about that, you know, about her elemental quality that is probably a little Melvillian.
And I know when you were on the New Yorker fiction podcast, you chose to read a short story by Don DeLillo. Mm-hmm. Do you see DeLillo in this book in any way?
Well, you know, there's one of my favorite DeLillo books, and a lot of people's favorite DeLillo books, is White Noise. And that's a book that I really enjoy. It's about a lot of things, consumerism again, kind of American storytelling through this deadened language of commerce. But it's also, you know, it also is filled with this kind of, you know, these waves in radiation and an airborne toxic event that is just this kind of this ominous atmosphere, literally over the landscape, you know, that we're infected by our society in ways that we just can't quite grasp. And if we could grasp it, we'd be horrified, right? And DeLillo expresses that. And I always felt that that book was a slightly dystopian novel, even though it's comic, of course, and satirical. So it's not realistic, but it shows a world in which all those kind of levers that are being pushed and pulled through language and advertising and all that kind of stuff are exposed so that we can really see it. And once we really see it, we're terrified.
You once said that your first three books you felt were more cerebral than the fourth, The Surrendered, and that The Surrendered relied more on something visual, that it relied more on the power of images. And I was curious how you would fit on such a full sea in that. Do you feel like it is more visual also, or how does it stand out or fit in with your books in that regard?
You know, I think it's a little bit of both. I think it's... The narrator of On Such a Full Sea is just as cerebral and self-interested as the narrators of those first three books in a different way. And we don't specify it and make it a discrete personality, but it is a personality full of all those anxieties we've been talking about. But it's an anxiety that, I mean, it's a personality that is completely entranced by image and all the things that Fan sees. And Fan's really the eyes and ears of the we. You know, that's their reach into the world. And without her, they'd have nothing. You know, they couldn't possibly see anything, and they allow her to imagine and have a freedom of imagination that they could never have before. So I think this book is a little bit of both those kinds of urges and perspectives.
And it has that ever-evolving mural as a plot point
yes.
in it as well.
Yes, yeah. And there's a lot of drawing and storytelling. There's a lot of the, not arts per se being produced, but the urge for an artistic kind of expression and action. And that's something that in the book, for me, almost is a political idea. You know, obviously the society is riven by lots of deep issues and problems, but what's the response? I don't have any political responses inside the book. The only political response is a kind of this artistic urge that begins to rise up.
Which is really also an assertion of a certain type of individuality.
I think so, yeah. And an assertion that we only become individuals when we have that creative urge. Mm-hmm. That we're not just consumers. We're not just surviving. You know, that's our gift as humans. It's not just about survival. It's not just about being comfortable. I think the book is worried that all those things are now perfectly acceptable definitions of being human. And it says, no, it's not. And fan is the only thing that really inspires that kind of urge, that other urge for, you know, a different kind of creation.
Do you have any books of the immigrant experience that are touchstones for you, or you know, fundamental books for you in becoming a writer?
Well, yeah, a couple. You know, one of them is a book that people don't really know about, is by Carlos Bulacan, a Filipino-American writer, called America's in the Heart. It's somewhat a sentimental novel, but full of kind of really searing scenes about just, you know, injustice and racism. But his, as I think you can tell by the title, America's in the Heart, there's such poignancy of his feeling for this land, even as it is, you know, mistreating him, and not seeing him. And there's something about that book that I just find deeply emotional and satisfying.
And do you have a sense of what your next project's going to be?
I don't like to talk about it so much, but I think it's also kind of Asia inflected. I've been traveling through Asia a lot, and I really feel as if Asia, and for a while it's been the case, but Asia is really this dynamic force in world affairs, a newer one, but continuing to, you know, its rise. To culturally and politically and economically, you know, influence what we know here in the West, and so I'm again probably going to follow some characters, maybe in a more traditional picaresque mode.
Interesting.
And have a lot of fun with it.
Do you have a sense of point of view, or you know, future versus realist?
I do, and it's going to be set now, but I think it'll be a little bit fantastical and magical.
That's
at
great.
The same time.
Well, it was a pleasure having you on Between the Covers today, Chiang Rai.
Thanks a lot. It was great.
We're talking today with Chiang Rai Lee, the author of On Such a Full Sea. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
Recently, the Portia Project hosted the Women in Prison Conference at Lewis and Clark Law School. Speakers covered many issues women face in prison and ideas for reform. Tune in to Prison Pipeline, February 24th at 6:30 p.m.
Community Radio is proud to host an open house to say goodbye to our interim station manager, Victoria Stoppiello,
and to welcome our new co-managers, Monica Beamer and Mike Crenshaw.
Please come to KBOO on March 1st between noon and 4 p.m. for greeting and meeting, snacks, tours, and a general celebration of the start of our 46th year broadcasting.
KBOO is located at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, a half block south of Burnside in Portland.
Again, this March 1st, noon to 4, here at your community radio station, KBOO. More information can be found at kboo.fm.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault, our weekly series that takes the history out of the oldest and largest collections of public radio programming in the United States and puts it back on the radio. This week on From the Vault, we pay tribute to one of the great voices of our time, poet Amiri Baraka, who died on Thursday, January 9th, 2014, at the age of 79.
This is called As a Possible Lover. As a possible lover practices silence, the way of wind bursting its early lull, cold morning to night we go so slowly without thought to ourselves. Enough to have thought tonight, nothing finishes it. What you are will have no certainty or end, that you will stay where you are. A human, gentle wisp of life. Ah, practices loneliness as a virtue. a single specious need to keep what you have never really had.
We'd like to share with you an interview that we did with him on November 11th, 2011, with journalist and author and colleague Joanne Griffith here on From the Vault. The Pacifica Radio Archives staff and From the Vault producers were privileged to invite Amiri Baraka to the archives, and we actually walked him down the corridors of our tape shelves and showed him the reel-to-reel tapes that were endangered and fragile, and the ones of not only him, but of his era and his friends and colleagues and poets and journalists that had also been rescued and saved, thanks to you, the listeners, and our patrons and our supporters. So here we are with Amiri Baraka visiting the Pacifica Radio Archives.
It is Tuesday, November the 15th, 2011. We're here at Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, and I'm so thrilled and honored to be sitting opposite Mr. Amiri Baraka. Thank you so much for joining us on your whistle-stop tour to the West Coast, and thank you for popping in to the Pacifica Radio Archives and having a spending a little bit of time with us, which you really appreciate. I'm going to start off. We just took a little wander around the archives, the actual vault of the archives, which people get to hear the audio that's played, but very few people, only the chosen few, get to actually go in and take a look. What were your thoughts walking among those 55,000 recordings, all those voices dating back to 1949?
Well, it's a priceless piece of living history, and it made me think for some reason of a science fiction movie where suddenly some oppressive government tried to destroy all the books. So it made me think of that kind of archive would be the kind of thing that would be destroyed by some kind of purely fascist kind of government to wipe out everybody's memory so that, you know, people wouldn't, like in 1984, so that people wouldn't even remember when there was an alternative form of government. So that all of that kind of living history is so very important, particularly now when the powerful forces are trying to make a corporate dictatorship. So the best thing to do would be to erase all memory of, you know, say the experiment of trying to get democracy and majority rule, and such an archive carries that history, and so you have to guard it and get ways to preserve it even better, you know, I think.
Which is where the public comes in. We always need your help in being able to preserve
That's
those
right.
voices. And the voices of people like you, Amiri Baraka. We're going to hear a few cuts from some of your work dating back to like 1964, another cut from 1967 we may have a listen to, and Wise, we're going to take a listen to that, I think, back from 1984 or so. But I want to start with a quote I was listening to in preparation for this interview, where it's 1964, you're holding a press conference. This was shortly after the Newark uprising in 1967, July of 1967. And this is what you said, and this really stood out to me, especially bearing in mind what is happening at the moment with the Occupy movement, where you say that we citizens have the right to rebel against an oppressive, illiterate governmental structure that does not even represent our will, the will of the majority. We black people in Newark are the majority. We are over 60% of the population of Newark, New Jersey, and we will govern ourselves, or no one will govern Newark, New Jersey. And that refrain, we will govern ourselves or no one will, you repeat a number of times throughout that press conference. At that point, relating that to what is happening now with the Occupy movement, literally just as we were coming into the studio, we heard that the judge in New York has allowed protesters to go back to Zuccotti Park, even though they were evacuated. He said, no, you know, you can't do that. You've got to let them back in. What are your thoughts on the Occupy movement now, bearing in mind what you were talking about over 40 years ago in terms of we will govern ourselves or no one will? We are the majority.
Well, it's a continuum. See, there's always a contradictory waves, a contradictory elements in society. So at one point, you're moving forward, but at the same time, their forces moving backward are trying to hold you back. So you're talking about 1967 to say when they still had black and white signs in the South, and we were saying in Newark that that's not happening here. You see, this is while Dr. King was down there fighting, while Malcolm, who had just been murdered. But we were saying that, no, this is not going to happen here. It's not going to continue here. This is it. This is over with. And however you react to that, note that there's nothing you can do to stop it. And I feel that's what the whole Occupy movement is. It's a continuation. But you see, the point is the people in the United States, even though you think America is advanced, still is backward because they have more access to the people's minds. You see, there's more propaganda for the people. There are more diversions. You know,
what kind of diversions when you say that? What do you mean?
Well, you know, radio, television, newspaper lies. You know, the American people are more propagandized than anybody on the planet. They know less about their history and culture than most people do. They don't think so because they have, you know, kind of gadgets and stuff. But in the real world, they are programmed to see the world almost exactly the opposite as it is, you see. So what's happening now in the Occupy movement, you have another generation of people in the main who have begun to see the whole flaws in what was the American, you know, the standard corporate-shaped image of America. They're seeing through that. And they're demanding some change. And obviously, the reason is the so-called collapse, economic collapse, in which the banks stole billions of dollars. Unfortunately, our president bailed them out. When I always questioned that from the day he got in there, even though I support him, I said, you should not bail out rich people with poor people's money. Mm. You know, there's no reason for you to take our money to help Bank of America. They're not going to give out any more loans.
And then Bank of America turns around and tries to charge us for using our own money.
That's right. That's right. No, I mean, it's just criminal enterprise, you know, the banks. And the point was, I said, if you believe in, you know, private profit, the market system, beautiful, go do that.